resistance and the presidency.
President John Kerbush or President George Berry? It's not a real choice, it's an apparent choice, like choosing a brand of detergent. Whether you buy Ivory, Snow or Tide, they are both owned by Procter & Gamble.
Today, Arundhati Roy, author of God of Small Things, for the hour. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, today broadcasting from Sacramento, California. I'm Amy Goodman. Heavy fighting has resumed in Najaf as U.S. warplanes bomb parts of the Holy City overnight. Backers of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr report the outer walls of the Imam Ali Shrine were damaged in the attacks. On Friday, a spokesperson for Iraq's Interior Ministry said that Sadr had agreed to surrender control of the Imam Ali Shrine and that Iraqi police were in control of the complex, but the claims proved to be false. At least five U.S. soldiers died over the weekend. More than 950 service members, U.S. service members, have now died since the invasion began. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, a member of the state's Air National Guard has killed himself one day after returning home from Iraq from a six-month tour. Technical Sergeant David Gwindon was 48 years old. The Iraq invasion marked the first time members of New Hampshire's Air National Guard had ever participated in Army combat mission. In other news from Iraq, the U.S. journalist Micah Garon was released yesterday after 8 days in captivity. He was working in Iraq investigating the looting of ancient archaeological sites in the Nasiriya area. In news from Afghanistan, the U.S. military has barred a U.N. human rights expert from visiting detention centers in Afghanistan where former detainees say they were abused and tortured. The U.N. official was allowed to see one prison run by Afghan authorities. He described the conditions as inhuman. Nine Republican members of the Senate Intelligence Committee have called for a radical overhaul of the nation's intelligence gathering operations by stripping considerable power from the CIA and Pentagon and giving it to a new national intelligence director. The Washington Post reports the plan came as a shock to both Senate Democrats and the White House. On the campaign front, John Kerry's service in Vietnam remained the top story in the presidential race over the weekend. On Friday, Kerry filed an FEC complaint alleging a group of Vietnam veterans who have attacked his military record were an illegal front group for the Bush campaign. Meanwhile, an editor at the Chicago Tribune, who served with Kerry 33 years ago, came public to defend Kerry's record in Vietnam. And former Republican Senator Bob Dole joined in the fray as well. He called on Kerry to apologize for once testifying that atrocities were committed in Vietnam, and he accused Kerry of receiving an early exit from combat for suffering, quote, superficial wounds. Meanwhile, Palestinian leaders are accusing the Bush administration of destroying hopes for peace in the Middle East by giving its covert support to Israel's expansion of settlements in the West Bank. This, according to a report in The Guardian of London. U.S. officials are privately admitting they've abandoned their demands that Israel freeze settlement activity and have given Jerusalem tacit permission to build thousands of new homes on the disputed land. Israeli political activist Jeff Halper told The Guardian, quote, effectively a new roadmap has been drawn between the U.S. and Israel, which the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia do not agree with. Meanwhile, in Gaza City, more than 4,000 Palestinians rallied on Sunday to show support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners who are staging a hunger strike in Israeli jails. The Sudanese government and rebel forces are meeting today in Nigeria to discuss brokering an accord in the western Darfur region. On Saturday, the Sudanese government signed an agreement with the UN Migration Agency to ensure that the estimated 1.4 million people driven from their villages by the Janjaweed militia can return home if they want. And the AFL-CIO and the Kerry Edwards campaign called on the Bush administration over the weekend to scrap new overtime regulations that go into effect today. The rule changes could strip up to 6 million workers of overtime benefits.
The new ruling party is holding the aces. The rest of the cards are all missing faces. I'm sorry I can't know you today. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us your sons and give us your daughters. No one is safe or immune from the slaughter. How indifference makes them rage. What can one say? I will not obey. National Guard or freedom fighters, all houses belong to...
The great folk singer Utah Phillips. I was with him last night at a celebration of KVMR radio, as well as community television in Nevada City, as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour around the country. This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Sacramento, California, from Access Sacramento, public access TV here in the state's capital. Tonight, I'll be at the Crest Theater at a benefit for KVMR. We've been on an intensive tour throughout the week. Last night, two nights ago, in Eureka, California, celebrating four independent media outlets, KIDE, Hoopa Valley Radio, KMUD, Redway Community Radio, KHSU at Humboldt State, and Humboldt Community Television. A few days before in Berkeley, celebrating KPFA and Pacifica with the great writer Arundhati Roy. Two nights before, she was in San Francisco addressing a packed audience of more than 2,000 at the American Sociological Association. Arundhati Roy won the prestigious Booker Prize for her book, The God of Small Things. She's also the author of several nonfiction books, her latest, An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire. Her speech is entitled Public Power in the Age of Empire. Today we spend the hour with Arundhati Roy.
When language has been butchered and bled of meaning, how do we understand public power? When freedom means occupation, when democracy means neoliberal capitalism, when reform means repression, when words like empowerment and peacekeeping make your blood run cold, why then public power could mean whatever you want it to mean. A biceps-building machine, or a community power shower. So I'll just have to define public power as I go along in my own self-serving sort of way. In India, the word public is now a Hindi word. It means people. In Hindi, we have sarkar and public, the government and the people. Inherent in this use is the underlying assumption that the government is quite separate from the people. This distinction has to do with the fact that India's freedom struggle was magnificent, but by no means revolutionary. The Indian elite stepped easily and elegantly into the shoes of British imperialists. A deeply impoverished, essentially feudal society became a modern, independent nation state. And even today, 57 years on to the day, yesterday was Independence Day, the truly vanquished still look upon the government as my bap, the parent and provider. The somewhat more radical, those who still have fire in their bellies, see it as chore, the thief, the snatcher away of all things. But either way, for most Indians, sarkar is very separate from public. But as you make your way up India's social ladder, the distinction between sarkar and public gets blurred. The Indian elite, like the elite anywhere in the world, finds it hard to separate itself from the state. It sees like the state, it thinks like the state, it speaks like the state. In the United States, on the other hand, the blurring of the distinction between sarkar and public has penetrated far deeper into society. This could be the sign of a robust democracy, but unfortunately, it's a little more complicated and less pretty than that. Among other things, it has to do with the elaborate web of paranoia generated by the US Sarkar and spun out by the corporate media and Hollywood. Ordinary Americans have been manipulated into imagining they're a people under siege, whose sole refuge and protector is their government. If it isn't the communists, it's the Al-Qaeda. If it isn't Cuba, it's Nicaragua. As a result of this, the most powerful nation in the world, with its unmatchable arsenal of weapons, its history of having waged and sponsored endless wars, and the only nation in history to have actually used nuclear bombs, is peopled by a terrified citizenry jumping at shadows. A people bonded to the state, not by social services or public health care or employment guarantees, but by fear. This synthetically manufactured fear is used to gain public sanction for further acts of aggression. And so it goes, building into a spiral of self-fulfilling hysteria, now formally calibrated by the US government's amazing technicolored terror alerts: fuchsia, turquoise, salmon pink. To outside observers, this merging of Sarkar and public in the United States sometimes makes it hard to separate the actions of the US government from the American people. It is this confusion that fuels anti-Americanism in the world. Anti-Americanism is then seized upon and amplified by the US government and its faithful media outlets. You know the routine: why do they hate us? They hate our freedoms, etc., etc. This enhances the sense of isolation among American people and makes the embrace between Sarkar and public even more intimate, like Red Riding Hood looking for a cuddle in the wolf's bed. Using the threat of an external enemy to rally people behind you is a tired old horse which politicians have ridden to power for centuries. But could it be that ordinary people are fed up of that poor old horse and are looking for something different? There's an old Hindi film song that goes, "Ye public hai, ye sab janti hai," which means, the public, she knows it all. Wouldn't it be lovely if the song were right and politicians wrong? Before Washington's illegal invasion of Iraq, a Gallup international poll showed that in no European country was the support for a unilateral war higher than 11%. On February 15th, 2003, weeks before the invasion, more than 10 million people marched against the war on different continents, including North America. And yet, the governments of many supposedly democratic nations still went to war. So the question is democracy still democratic? Are democratic governments accountable to the people who elected them? And critically, is the public in democratic countries responsible for the actions of its Sarkar? If you think about it, the logic that underlies the war on terrorism and the logic that underlies terrorism is exactly the same. Both make ordinary citizens pay for the actions of their government. Al-Qaeda made the people of the United States pay with their lives for the actions of their government in Palestine, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The US government has made the people of Afghanistan pay in their thousands for the actions of the Taliban, and the people of Iraq pay in their hundreds of thousands for the actions of Saddam Hussein. But the crucial difference is that nobody really elected the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or Saddam Hussein. But the President of the United States was elected. Well, in a manner of speaking. Yeah. The prime ministers of Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom were elected. Could it then be argued that the citizens of these countries are more responsible for the actions of their government than Iraqis are for the actions of Saddam Hussein or Afghans for the Taliban? Whose God decides which is a just war and which isn't? George Bush Sr. once said, "I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are." When the president of the most powerful country in the world doesn't need to care what the facts are, then we can at least be sure we've entered the age of empire. So what does public power mean in the age of empire? Does it mean anything at all? Does it actually exist? In these allegedly democratic times, conventional political thought holds that public power is exercised through the ballot. Scores of countries in the world will go to the polls this year. Most, not all of them, will get the governments they vote for. But will they get the governments they want? In India this year, we voted the Hindu nationalists out of office. But even as we celebrated, we knew that on nuclear bombs, neoliberalism, privatization, censorship, big dams, on every major issue other than overt Hindu nationalism, the Congress and the BJP have no major ideological differences. We know that it is the 50-year legacy of the Congress Party that prepared the ground culturally and politically for the far right. It was also the Congress Party that first opened India's markets to corporate globalization. In its election campaign, the Congress indicated it was prepared to rethink some of its earlier economic policies. Millions of India's poorest people came out in strength to vote in the elections. The spectacle of the great Indian democracy was telecast live. The poor farmers, the old and infirm, the veiled women with their beautiful silver jewelry making quaint journeys to election booths on elephants and camels and bullock carts. Contrary to the predictions of all India's experts and pollsters, Congress won more votes than any other party. India's Communist Party has won the largest share of the vote in their history. India's poor had clearly voted against neoliberalism's economic reforms and growing fascism. As soon as the votes were counted, the corporate media dispatched the poor like badly paid extras on a film set. Television channels featured split screens. Half the screen showed the chaos outside the home of Sonia Gandhi, the leader of the Congress Party, as the coalition government was cobbled together. The other half showed frenzied stockbrokers outside the Bombay Stock Exchange, panicking at the thought that the Congress might actually honor its promises and implement its electoral mandate. We saw the Sensex stock index move up and down and sideways. The media, whose own publicly listed stocks were plummeting, reported the stock market crash as though Pakistan had launched ICBMs on Delhi. Even before the new government was formally sworn in, senior Congress politicians made public statements reassuring investors and the media that privatization of public utilities would continue. Meanwhile, the BJP, now in opposition, has cynically and comically begun to oppose foreign direct investment and further opening of the Indian market. So this is the spurious, evolving dialectic of electoral democracy. As for the Indian poor, once they've provided the votes, they're expected to bugger off home. Policy will be decided despite them.
Arundhati Roy, author of An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, speaking in San Francisco just a few days ago. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, as well as the transcript, or you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. We'll be back with the great Indian writer, author of God of Small Things, in a minute.
One cold autumn morning, the leaves had turned brown. A hobo come tramping through a small western town. He walked through the churchyard to the preacher's back door, where he knew there was refuge and room for the poor. He knocked and then waited for the preacher to come with just a kind word for a broken down bum. The preacher arrived and looked out in dismay. With a few angry words, he drove him away. Oh, if you won't offer me something to eat.
Utah Phillips singing Room for the Poor here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Sacramento, California. California, where Arundhati Roy just was, in San Francisco, actually, just south of here, addressing the American Sociological Association.
And what of the U.S. elections? Do U.S. voters have real choice? It's true that if John Kerry becomes president, some of the oil tycoons and Christian fundamentalists in the White House will change. Few will be sorry to see the back of Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld or John Ashcroft and their blatant thuggery. But the real concern is that in the new administration, their policies will continue, that we'll have Bushism without Bush. Those in positions of real power, the bankers, the CEOs, are not vulnerable to the vote. In any case, they fund both sides. Unfortunately, the importance of the U.S. elections has deteriorated into a sort of personality contest, a squabble over who would do a better job of overseeing empire. John Kerry believes in the idea of empire as fervently as George Bush does. The U.S. political system has been carefully crafted to ensure that no one who questions the natural goodness of the military-industrial corporate power structure will be allowed through the portals of power. Given this, it's no surprise that in this election you have two Yale University graduates, both members of Skull and Bones, the same secret society, both millionaires, both playing at soldier, both talking up war and arguing almost childishly about who would lead the war on terror more effectively. Like President Bill Clinton before him, Kerry will continue the expansion of U.S. economic and military penetration into the world. He says he would have voted to authorize Bush to go to war in Iraq, even if he had known that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. He promises to commit more troops to Iraq. He said recently that he supports Bush's policies towards Israel and Ariel Sharon 100%. He says he'll retain 98% of Bush's tax cuts. So, underneath the shrill exchange of insults, there's almost absolute consensus. It looks as though even if Americans vote for Kerry, they'll still get Bush. President John Kerbush or President George Berry. It's not a real choice, it's an apparent choice, like choosing a brand of detergent. Whether you buy Ivory, Snow, or Tide, they are both owned by Procter & Gamble. But this doesn't mean that one takes a position that is entirely without nuance, that the Congress and the BJP, New Labour and the Tories, the Democrats and the Republicans are the same. Of course they are not. Neither are Tide and Ivory Snow. Tide has oxy-boosting and Ivory Snow is a gentle cleanser. In India, there is a difference between an overtly fascist party, the BJP, and a party that slyly pits one community against another, the Congress, and sows the seeds of communalism that are then so ably harvested by the BJP. There are differences in the IQs and levels of ruthlessness between this year's US presidential candidates. The anti-war movement in the United States has done an absolutely phenomenal job of exposing the lies and venality. I'll give them a clap. Of exposing the lies and venality that led to the invasion of Iraq, despite the propaganda and intimidation it faced. This was a service not just to people here, but to all of us in the world. But now, if the anti-war movement openly campaigns for Kerry, the rest of the world will think that it approves of his policies of sensitive imperialism, if that isn't an oxymoron. Is U.S. imperialism preferable if it is supported by the United Nations and European countries? Is it preferable if the U.N. asks Indian and Pakistani soldiers to do the killing and dying in Iraq instead of U.S. soldiers? Is the only change that Iraqis can hope for that French, German, and Russian companies will share in the spoils of the occupation of their country? Is it actually better or worse for those of us who live in subject nations? Is it better for the world to have a smarter emperor in power or a stupider one? Is that our only choice? I'm sorry, I know these are uncomfortable and even brutal questions, but they must be asked. The fact is that electoral democracy has become a process of cynical manipulation. It offers us a very reduced political space today, and to believe that this space constitutes real choice would be naive. The crisis in modern democracy is a profound one. On the global stage, beyond the jurisdiction of sovereign governments, international instruments of trade and finance oversee a complex system of multilateral laws and agreements that have entrenched a system of appropriation that puts colonialism to shame. This system allows the unrestricted entry and exit of massive amounts of speculative capital, hot money, they call it, into and out of third world countries, which then effectively dictates their economic policy. Using the threat of capital flight as a lever, international capital insinuates itself deeper and deeper into these economies. Giant transnational corporations are taking control of their essential infrastructure and natural resources, their minerals, their water, their electricity. The World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Asian Development Bank, and other financial institutions virtually write economic policy and parliamentary legislation. With a deadly combination of arrogance and ruthlessness, they take their sledgehammers to fragile, interdependent, historically complex societies and devastate them. And all this goes under the fluttering banner of reform. As a consequence of this reform in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, thousands of small enterprises and industry have closed down. Millions of workers and farmers have lost their jobs and land. But the Spectator newspaper in London assures us that, quote, we live in the happiest, healthiest, and most peaceful era in human history. Billions wonder, who's we? Where does he live? What's his Christian name? The thing to understand is that modern democracy is safely premised on an almost religious acceptance of the nation state. But corporate globalization is not. Liquid capital is not. So even though capital needs the coercive powers of the nation state to put down revolts in the servants' quarters, this setup ensures that no individual nation can oppose corporate globalization on its own. Radical change cannot and will not be negotiated by governments. It can only be enforced by people, by the public, by a public who can link hands across national borders. So when we speak of public power in the age of empire, I hope it's not presumptuous to assume that the only thing that is worth discussing seriously is the power of a dissenting public, a public which disagrees with the very concept of empire, a public which has set itself against incumbent power, international, national, regional, or provincial governments and institutions that support and service empire. What are the avenues of protest available to people who wish to resist empire? By resist, I don't mean only to express dissent, but to effectively force change. Empire has a range of calling cards. It uses different weapons to break open different markets. You know, the checkbook and the cruise missile. For poor people in many countries, empire doesn't always appear in the form of cruise missiles and tanks as it has in Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam. Sometimes it appears in their lives in very local avatars, losing their jobs, being sent unpayable electricity bills, having their water supply cut, being evicted from their homes and uprooted from their land. All this overseen by the repressive machinery of the state, the police, the army, the judiciary. It's a process of relentless impoverishment with which the poor are historically familiar. What empire does is to further entrench and exacerbate already existing inequalities. Even until quite recently, it was sometimes difficult for people to see themselves as victims of the conquests of empire. But now local struggles have begun to see their role with increasing clarity. However grand it might sound, the fact is that they are confronting empire in their own very different ways, differently in Iraq, differently in South Africa, in India, in Argentina, and differently, for that matter, on the streets of Europe and the United States. Mass resistance movements, individual activists, journalists, artists, and filmmakers have come together to strip empire of its sheen. They have connected the dots, turned cash flow charts and boardroom speeches into real stories about real people and real despair. They have shown how the neoliberal project has cost people their homes, their lands, their jobs, their liberty, and their dignity. They have made the intangible tangible. The once seemingly incorporeal enemy, is now corporeal. This is a huge victory. It was forged by the coming together of disparate political groups with a variety of strategies. But they all recognize that the target of their anger, their activism, and their doggedness is the same. And this was the beginning of real globalization, the globalization of dissent. Broadly speaking, there are two kinds of mass resistance movements in third world countries today. The Landless People's Movement in Brazil, the Anti-Dam Movement in India, the Zapatistas in Mexico, the Anti-Privatization Forum in South Africa, and hundreds of others are fighting their own sovereign governments, which have become agents of the neoliberal project. Most of these are radical struggles fighting to change the structure and chosen model of development in their own societies. And then there are those fighting formal and brutal neocolonial occupations in contested territories whose boundaries and fault lines were often arbitrarily drawn last century by imperialist powers. In Palestine, Tibet, Chechnya, Kashmir, and several states in India's northeast provinces, people are waging struggles for self-determination. Several of these struggles might have been radical and even revolutionary when they began, but often the brutality of the repression they face pushes them into conservative, even retrogressive spaces in which they use the same violent strategies and the same language of religious and cultural nationalism used by the states they seek to replace. Many of the foot soldiers in these struggles will find, like those who fought apartheid in South Africa, that once they overcome overt occupation, they will be left with another battle on their hands, a battle against covert economic colonialism. Meanwhile, as the rift between the rich and poor is being driven deeper and the battle to control the world's resources intensifies, economic colonialism, through formal military aggression, is staging a comeback. Iraq today is a tragic illustration of this process. An illegal invasion, a brutal occupation in the name of liberation, the rewriting of laws that allows the shameless appropriation of the country's wealth and resources by corporations allied to the occupation, and now the charade of a local Iraqi government. For these reasons, it is absurd to condemn the resistance to the U.S. occupation in Iraq as being masterminded by terrorists or insurgents or supporters of Saddam Hussein. After all, if the United States were invaded and occupied, would everybody who fought to liberate it be a terrorist or an insurgent or a Bushite? The Iraqi resistance is fighting on the front lines of the battle against empire, and therefore that battle is our battle. Like most resistance movements, it combines a motley range of assorted factions, former Baathists, liberals, Islamists, fed-up collaborationists, communists, and so on. Of course, it's riddled with opportunism, local rivalry, demagoguery, and criminality. But if we're only going to support pristine movements, then no resistance will be worthy of our purity. This is not to say that we shouldn't ever criticize resistance movements. Many of them suffer from a lack of democracy, from the iconization of their leaders, a lack of transparency, a lack of vision and direction. But most of all, they suffer from vilification, repression, and lack of resources. So before we prescribe how a pristine Iraqi resistance must conduct their secular, feminist, democratic, nonviolent battle, we should shore up our end of the resistance by forcing the U.S. and its allies to withdraw from Iraq.
The writer Arundhati Roy addressing the American Sociological Association in San Francisco. We will be back with her in just a minute. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Let me sing to you all the old songs I know of wild, windy places locked in timeless snow and white crimson deserts where the muddy rivers flow. It's sad, but the telling takes me home. Come along with me to some places that I've been, where people all look back and still remember when, and the quicksilver legends like sunlight turn and blend. It's sad, but the telling takes me home. We'll walk along some wagon roads or down the iron rail, past lines of rusty Cadillacs that mark the boomtown trail, where dreamers never win and doers never fail. It's sad.
Utah Phillips singing The Telling Takes Me Home. Here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman, as we return to the great writer Arundhati Roy addressing the American Sociological Association in San Francisco.
As resistance movements have begun to reach across national borders and pose a real threat, governments have developed their own strategies of how to deal with them. They range from co-optation to repression. I'm going to speak about three of the contemporary dangers that confront resistance movements today: the difficult meeting point between mass movements and the mass media, the hazards of the NGOization of resistance, and the confrontation between resistance movements and increasingly repressive states. The place in which the mass media meets mass movements is a complicated one. Governments have learned that a crisis-driven media cannot afford to hang about in the same place for too long. Like business houses need a cash turnover, the media needs crisis turnover. Whole countries become old news, they cease to exist, and the darkness becomes deeper than before the light was briefly shone on them. We saw it happen in Afghanistan when the Soviets withdrew, and now after Operation Enduring Freedom put the CIA's Hamid Karzai in place, Afghanistan has been thrown to its warlords once more. Another CIA operative, Iyad Alawi, has been installed in Iraq, so perhaps it's coming up for time for the media to move on from there too. But while governments hone the art of waiting out crises, resistance movements are increasingly being ensnared in a vortex of crisis production, seeking ways to find ways of manufacturing them in easily consumable, spectator-friendly formats. Every self-respecting people's movement, every issue is supposed to have its own hot air balloon in the sky, advertising its brand and purpose. For this reason, starvation deaths are more effective advertisements for impoverishment than millions of malnourished people who don't quite make the cut. Dams are not newsworthy until the devastation they wreak makes good television, and by then it's too late. Standing in the reservoir, in the rising water of a reservoir for days on end, watching your home and belongings float away to protest against a big dam, used to be an effective strategy, but it isn't anymore. The media's dead bored of that one. So the hundreds of thousands of people being displaced by dams are expected to either conjure new tricks or give up the struggle. Colorful demonstrations and weekend marches are vital, but alone are not powerful enough to stop wars. Wars will be stopped only when soldiers refuse to fight, when workers refuse to load weapons onto ships. And when people boycott the economic outposts of empire that are strung across the globe. If we want to reclaim the space for civil disobedience, we will have to liberate ourselves from the tyranny of crisis reportage and its fear of the mundane. We have to use our experience, our imagination, and our art to interrogate the instruments of the state that ensure that normality remains what it is, cruel, unjust, and unacceptable. We have to expose the policies and processes that make ordinary things, food, water, shelter, and dignity, such a distant dream for ordinary people. Real preemptive strike is to understand that wars are the end result of flawed and unjust peace. As far as mass resistance movements are concerned, the fact is that no amount of media coverage can make up for mass strength on the ground. There's no option really to old-fashioned, back-breaking political mobilization. Corporate globalization has increased the distance between those who make decisions and those who have to suffer the effects of those decisions. Forums like the WSF enable local resistance movements to reduce that distance and to link up with their counterparts in rich countries. And that alliance is an important and formidable one. For example, when India's first private dam, the Maheshwar Dam, was being built, alliances between the Narmada Bachao Andolan, the NBA, the German organization Urgewald, the Bern Declaration in Switzerland, and the International Rivers Network here in Berkeley worked together to push a series of international banks and corporations out of the project. This would not have been possible had there not been a rock-solid resistance movement on the ground. The voice of that local movement was amplified by supporters on the global stage, embarrassing and forcing investors to withdraw. An infinite number of similar alliances targeting specific projects and specific corporations would help to make another world possible. We should begin with the corporations who did business with Saddam Hussein and now profit from the devastation and occupation of Iraq. A second hazard facing mass movements is the NGOization of resistance. It'll be easy to twist what I'm about to say into an indictment of all NGOs, but that would be a falsehood. In the murky waters of fake NGOs set up to siphon off grant money, or as tax dodgers, in states like Bihar they're given as dowry. Of course there are NGOs doing valuable work, but it's important to consider the NGO phenomenon in a broader context. In India, for instance, the funded NGO boom began in the late 1980s and early 1990s. It coincided with the opening of India's markets to neoliberalism. At the time, the Indian state, in keeping with the requirements of structural adjustment, was withdrawing funding from rural development, agriculture, energy, transport, and public health. As the state abdicated its traditional role, NGOs moved in to work in these very areas. The difference, of course, is that the funds available to them are a minuscule fraction of the actual cut in public spending. Most large funded NGOs are financed and patronized by aid and development agencies, which are in turn funded by Western governments, the World Bank, the UN, and some multinational corporations. Though they may not be the very same agencies, they are certainly part of the same loose political formation that oversees the neoliberal project and demands the slash in government spending in the first place. Why should these agencies fund NGOs? Could it just be old-fashioned missionary zeal? Guilt? It's a little more than that. NGOs give the impression that they are filling the vacuum created by a retreating state. And they are, but in a materially inconsequential way. Their real contribution is that they diffuse political anger and dole out as aid or benevolence what people ought to have by right. NGOs alter the public psyche. They turn people into dependent victims and blunt the edge of political resistance. They form a sort of buffer between the sarkar and the public, between empire and its subjects. They have become the arbitrators, the facilitators. In the long run, NGOs are accountable to their funders, not to the people they're working amongst. They're what botanists would call an indicator species. It's almost as though the greater the devastation caused by neoliberalism, the greater the outbreak of NGOs. Nothing illustrates this more poignantly than the phenomenon of the US preparing to invade a country and simultaneously readying NGOs to go in and clean up the devastation. In order to make sure their funding isn't jeopardized and that the governments of the countries they work in will allow them to continue to function, NGOs have to present their work in a shallow framework, more or less shorn of a political or historical context, at any rate an inconvenient political or historical context. Apolitical, and therefore extremely political, distress reports from poor countries and war zones eventually make the dark people of these dark countries seem like pathological victims. Another malnutritioned Indian, another starving Ethiopian, another Afghan refugee camp, another maimed Sudanese in need of the white man's help. They unwittingly reinforce racist stereotypes and reaffirm the achievements, the comforts, and the compassion, the tough love of Western civilization. they're the secular missionaries of the modern world. But eventually, on a smaller scale, but more insidiously, the capital available to NGOs plays the same role in alternative politics as the speculative capital that flows in and out of the economies of poor countries. It begins to dictate the agenda. It turns confrontation into negotiation. It depoliticizes resistance. It interferes with local people's movements that have traditionally been self-reliant. NGOs have funds that can employ local people who might otherwise be activists in resistance movements, but now can feel they're doing some immediate creative good and earning a living while they're at it. Real political resistance offers no such shortcuts. The NGOization of politics threatens to turn resistance into a well-mannered, reasonable, salaried 9-to-5 job with a few perks thrown in. But real resistance has real consequences and no salary. And this brings us to the third danger I want to speak about tonight, the deadly nature of the actual confrontation between resistance movements and increasingly repressive states, between public power and the agents of empire. Whenever civil resistance has shown the slightest signs of evolving from symbolic action into anything remotely threatening, the crackdown is merciless. We've seen what happened in the demonstrations in Seattle, in Miami, in Gothenburg, in Genoa. In the United States, you have the USA Patriot Act, which has become a blueprint for anti-terrorism laws passed by governments across the world. Freedoms are being curbed in the name of protecting freedom. And once we surrender our freedoms, to win them back will take a revolution. There is no discussion taking place in the world today that is more crucial than the debate about strategies of resistance. And the choice of strategy is not entirely in the hands of the public. It is also in the hands of Sarkar. After all, when the US invades and occupies Iraq in the way it has done, with such overwhelming military force, can the resistance be expected to be a conventional military one? Of course, even if it were conventional, it would still be called terrorist. But in a strange sense, the US government's arsenal of weapons and unrivaled air and firepower makes terrorism an all but inescapable response. What people lack in wealth and power, they will make up with stealth and strategy. In this restive, despairing time, if governments do not do all they can to honor nonviolent resistance, then by default they privilege those who turn to violence. No government's condemnation of terrorism is credible if it cannot show itself to be open to change by nonviolent dissent. But instead, nonviolent resistance movements are being crushed. Any kind of mass political mobilization or organization is being bought off or broken or simply ignored. Meanwhile, governments and the corporate media, and let's not forget the film industry, lavish their time, attention, technology, research, and admiration on war and terrorism. Violence has been deified. The message this sends is disturbing and dangerous. If you seek to air a public grievance, violence is more effective than nonviolence. As the rift between the rich and poor grows, as the need to appropriate and control the world's resources to feed the great capitalist machine becomes more urgent, the unrest will only escalate. For those of us who are on the wrong side of empire, the humiliation is becoming unbearable. Each of the Iraqi children killed by the United States was our child. Each of the prisoners tortured in Abu Ghraib was our comrade. Each of their screams was ours. When they were humiliated, we were humiliated. The US soldiers fighting in Iraq, mostly volunteers in a poverty draft from small towns and poor urban neighborhoods are victims just as much as the Iraqis of the same horrendous process which asks them to die for a victory that will never be theirs. And then from the ruins of Afghanistan, from the rubble of Iraq and Chechnya, from the streets of occupied Palestine and the mountains of Kashmir, from the hills and plains of Colombia and the forests of Andhra Pradesh and Assam, comes the chilling reply. There's no alternative to terrorism. Terrorism, armed struggle, insurgency, call it what you want. Terrorism is vicious, ugly, and dehumanizing for its perpetrators as well as its victims. But so is war. You could say that terrorism is the privatization of war. Terrorists are the free marketeers of war. They are people who don't believe that the state has a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. Human society is journeying to a terrible place. But of course, there's an alternative to terrorism. It's called justice. And it's time to recognize that no amount of nuclear weapons or full-spectrum dominance or daisy cutters or spurious governing councils and lawyer jirgas can buy us peace at the cost of justice. The urge for hegemony and preponderance by some will be matched with greater intensity by the longing for dignity and justice by others. Exactly what form that battle takes, whether it's beautiful or bloodthirsty, depends on us.
Arundhati Roy, addressing the American Sociological Association in San Francisco just a few days ago. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359, or you can go to our website at democracynow.org. I look forward to seeing people tonight as we broadcast from Access Sacramento tonight at the Crest Theater at 10th and K here in California's capital of Sacramento, as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour next Saturday night at Riverside Church in New York. And we'll be headed to Asheville, North Carolina, as well as Harrisonburg, Virginia, on the weekend following the Republican National Convention that we will be broadcasting to you. Breaking with Convention will be expanding to 2 hours. Your stations may be airing the full 2 hours, or you can go to our website at democracynow.org. So many people to thank. Our team at Democracy Now! Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, Uri Galed, Dennis Moynihan, and Chuck Skurich here in California, and Access Sacramento crew, Ron Cooper, Martin Anaya, Dev Singh, Comrades Nadimi, Bim Kumar Reyes, Rick Copeland, Renee Chavez, Tyler Campbell, Kim Leahy, also Angela Alston and Chris Zucker. We thank you very much as well, and Rich Kim. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. Again, see people tonight, Crest Theater, Sacramento at 7:30. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.